Hello, everybody. Welcome back to This Weird House. I am Nick Boddick, and today I am here with a gentleman I have had the pleasure of speaking with before. He is a writer. His name is Simon Stranzis. How are you today, Simon?
I'm doing fine, Nick.
For sure. So, again, thank you. I appreciate you doing this. It's been fun talking again to all the people that I look up to in writing, and you are one of those people. I did want to talk to you, or one of the several things I wanted to talk to you about was you were an editor on, I totally forgot to do my, for to double check on this, one of the year's best, Michael Kelly's Year's Best Weird Fiction.
That's right.
I just kind of want to talk about like the process of that and how that all went. And I guess, how did your personal tastes, I guess, and your views on weird fiction, how did that kind of shape the stories you ended up choosing for that book?
Well, the way it worked with the Year's Best Weird Fiction series was Michael was the primary reader. So everything would come into him. He'd read it. He would filter out, or I should say, winnow down the list of stories to anything he liked. And then he would forward that list over to me in this case, or to the, obviously to me, the other editors. All of we editors were able to select our own stories if we wanted to, our own being our own tastes rather than our own personal stories. Yeah, we were given latitude to pull in whatever we wanted ourselves, but he also provided a list. When I did it, I asked for the stories to be sent to me blind, by lines stripped from them. I know personally that I would have an issue with reading stories by people I know, and I would be unfairly influenced by it. So right. To avoid that, I didn't see who anyone was. Some of them I could guess while reading. Some people have, they have their own voices and you can pick out those voices. But for the most part, I didn't know who I was reading until I picked out, narrowed down to my final list. As for how my own personal tastes affect it, I mean, there's not much to talk about there. It's what my tastes shows. I tend to, I think, veer a little more towards the horror side than some of the editors who preceded me, like Laird Barron and Kathy Kocha. I guess those were the only two. I was a little more traditional horror and maybe a little bit more European horror, like the like D.P. Watt, for example. But yeah, for the most part, I think the stories were, they were my stories. They were stories that I would enjoy reading, and that's why I picked them.
For sure. That makes sense. actually, speaking of European horror, that is something that I know absolutely nothing about. From what it sounds like, you're a big fan of European horror fiction?
Yeah, when I say European, I mean, I sort of differentiate, and again, this is a gross exaggeration, but I differentiate between what's being done in North America and what's being done in England, and even what's being done in most is done in England. And when I say European horror, I guess I refer more to stuff that's influenced by authors like Machen and Bruno Schultz, for example. Just is a different blend of horror that they do over there than we necessarily do in North America, where it's more cowboy-esque, for lack of a better word. We have a lot more investigators encountering the supernatural, whereas over there it's more about weird stuff happening to people, and it's more interior, I suppose.
For sure. Yeah, that makes sense. There's definitely an abundance of detective-based supernatural fiction in American horror. North American horror.
Right. Like a good example might be Mark Samuels, right? His work's not what you would typically get out of an American writer. And it's not even what you get from the typical British writer. It's more, it draws more influences from a different strain of fiction than we normally see in contemporary horror.
For sure. For sure. Kind of a very broad question here. How did you get into writing horror?
Well, I mean, you know, I got into writing horror because I was reading a lot of horror. I started reading horror probably when I was around 16, I think. And, you know, these things are kind of fuzzy. I know some of my contemporaries have a whole history where they grew up reading the genre. I didn't really grow up reading the genre. I grew up, you know, reading action adventure books like the Mac Bolan Executioner books and Stony Ridge and that sort of thing. And I wasn't doing a lot of reading at the time, but I read a lot of comic books. And like every kid, you know, at that time, I eventually found the Sandman comics, found Neil Gaiman's series, right?
Like everybody. It's the nearest and dearest comic to my heart.
Yeah, it's sickening how many of us enjoy it. But so I found the Sandman books. Reading through the letters pages, because back then comics had letters pages, he mentioned Barker's Cabal. I think he mentioned it. He definitely mentioned Clive Barker. So I thought, you know, hey, this sort of sounds like a superhero yarn. I'm going to go pick up that book. And I brought it home and I read it, and I read it in a day. It's not a very long book, but still. And I was just, you know, I was blown away by it, and I wanted more. And it was just basically down the rabbit hole of Barker and then King and then, you know, short stories. And I found Straub, and then it just, you know, just went all over the place. So, you know, I'd been reading a lot of horror, and horror really appealed to me. And so when I started writing on my own, horror was what I naturally gravitated to. It was, you know, it was what I was enjoying the most. So I started focusing on that.
For sure. For sure. If I, so kind of veering away from horror directly a little bit, I haven't had anyone who is a especially big comic fan on yet. What kind of comics did you like when you were a kid?
Oh, geez, man. You know, I started with superhero comics like everyone else. You know, it was probably, I don't know if X-Men was the big thing when I was younger. Probably was. It was definitely the Marvel age. Everyone was reading Marvel and no one was reading DC. Then eventually, you know, Sandman started and I was attracted to that. Then Shade the Changing Man, which was, you know, chef's kiss for me. It was Peter Milligan and Chris Bacalo. I loved Shade the Changing Man. Yep. And then they started the whole Vertigo line, and I just, you know, I went head first into Vertigo. So, you know, The Invisibles, what are their things? Sebastian Oh, The Enigma, you know, just basically all the Hellblazer, obviously, all the big Vertigo stuff, Swamp Thing. I just keep going and naming them off. But yeah, so the Vertigo stuff was really my jam and what I love the most. And of course, Hellboy, like every red-blooded horror writer.
Naturally. Yeah, the Sandman, I really only discovered Sandman probably 5 years ago or so. And I was real big into comics when I was a kid, but I was very kind of vanilla about it. Like I read Spider-Man. I've always been a big Spider-Man fan. Like Spider-Man, X-Men, the basics of Marvel. But as I've grown up, I have gravitated more towards DC, actually, despite my best efforts. I am a diehard Batman fan. It's in my blood. And, but no, Sandman, I caught Sandman right when I was, I'm not going to go through my whole writing history, but like I got my start writing in like 2015-ish. On this Reddit community called No Sleep, which is a place for short horror, if you're familiar. Yeah. And I was just starting to veer away from that because I kind of realized that there is definitely a roof there that I had hit in terms of developing as a writer. And I was starting to take writing more seriously. And it was right around that time that I started to, or that I discovered Sandman. And like, it sounds melodramatic, but like it changed my life. Like as a writer, it was such an, like I had never, despite having read comics for literally as long as I've been capable of doing so, it was something I had never seen done in the medium before. And like what Gaiman did is just, I don't know. It's just, I have all five of the absolute edition sitting right up there right now, plus the death and the, whatever the other one is, I can't remember. And like the first handful of issues are, I mean, 24 Hours is of course like an iconic horror comic. And that was originally why I started reading it, is because by that point I was all in on horror. And, but once it kind of got out of that and got into more serialized storytelling, where you start learning just like that first, cause as far as I know, they only, Gaiman thought they were only going to get about 8 issues or maybe 12 or something like that. So he wrote a very self-contained story, but once it was a runaway hit, he started telling the broader story, and that was just something I'd never seen before. And it was, it was amazing. I could talk about Sandman all day. I won't. Everybody, you're welcome. But
High Bender did a good book about Sandman probably more than a few years ago at this point. Gaiman's those first 8 issues, Gaiman was really trying, I think he's gone record saying he's trying to explore different aspects of horror in those first 8 issues. So you get, I think, issue 3, where they're visiting one of Constantine's ex-girlfriends who's got the sand pouch. I think that's more of a British horror story, for example. And then, he kind of does different types of horror in those first 8 issues. But then, like you say, he really expands it out. And the whole, it's interesting when you go back and reread it and you understand that it's a story about stories. Because every plot, every little interstitial story is about the act of storytelling itself. And it's a great series. It took forever to come out back in the day, but
I've read about that. The delays, it was like 6
months between issues and stuff, but they were pretty it's a pretty awesome series.
And like you, Sandman also just, it got me into the Vertigo line. I'm not gonna relist them all. I read all the same ones you listed. I just got I recently got and read Swamp Thing, Alan Moore's Swamp Thing for the first time. And that was another one that was just like, my God, and obviously I wasn't reading it I don't think I was alive at the time it came out, but like I can imagine the impact it had on the industry when that came out, for both Sandman and Swamp Thing.
I mean, especially for Swamp Thing, I mean, what was being done before then, it's everything you know is wrong, right? Like just Alan Moore came in after one issue to tie up loose ends, I think. And then he started on his series where he basically said, everything you know about Swamp Thing, throw out the window. This is brand new stuff. And he's taking Swamp Thing to hell and meeting Etrigan and stuff. It was really, it was the start of the British invasion, as they say. Mm-hmm. And, when all those British writers started coming over, they really made a big difference.
For sure. And Swamp Thing actually has one of my favorite, I guess, lores in all of comics. Mm-hmm. Just the whole concept of the green and the red and the rot. Like that's one that is a character, or I guess like a series that has done consistently cooler things throughout its run, even to the present day. Scott Snyder did a short run on it, and he's one of my favorites right now. He's a big horror guy too. And I don't know, that's Swamp Thing has quickly become one of my, I wouldn't have put him in my top 10 a year ago today, but I think I would now. Like I haven't read a bad story with him yet. But okay, going back directly to horror, if you don't mind my around.
No worries.
I am more than happy to talk comics for the rest of my life, actually.
Well, my comics, I stopped reading comics religiously about, it's been a while. It's been a few years. So if it's anything before the 2000s, I'm set. After that, I start getting spotty as to what's happened and how much I can talk about. So
for sure. And I coincidentally, I really don't keep up all that much with. There's probably three or four books I keep up with on like a monthly or, you know, a new current basis, but it's actually pretty much the same for me. I read a lot of stuff that I don't like waiting. So like I'll usually wait until a run is all the way out. And yeah. If it's an ongoing, I might not read it if it goes for another 5 years. But yeah, no, it's pretty much all the stuff from like 70s, 80s, and 90s is where I'm about at too.
All right. So, good.
Yeah. So you say it was Barker that you really got into first, and then mm-hmm. King. I'd love to talk about some King.
So I've read King. I'm not going to tell you I was in love with King like I was with Barker or Straub. Those were my guys. But yeah, I've certainly read my fair share of King like everybody has.
For sure. And actually, if I may redirect, based on what you just said, what was it about Barker and Straub versus King that, like, what grabbed those two more than King did?
So, well, like I said, Barker was my first. Barker, and what's great about Barker, especially with the Books of Blood, is much like Gaiman, he really took you on a tour of horror with the Books of Blood, right? Almost every story was a different facet of the genre. So if you liked quiet horror, there was a story in there for you. If you liked splatterpunks horror, something was in there for you. Like whatever you wanted, you could find it in the Books of Blood. And what Barker was doing was very transgressive for the time. He was introducing, you know, what he called the perverse into horror. And that was really, especially North American horror, that really wasn't done, right? It was, America's always been more of a puritanical country. And him introducing this sort of S&M, black leather, trans, I don't know if the right word I'm looking for is, but sort of the amorphous sexuality, this is bizarre, and then in horror. Straub, on the other hand, Straub's much more of a traditional writer, but unlike King, I think he's much more of a literate writer. His work was elevated to some degree, and if you were a snobby reader, you liked Straub more than you liked King. Now, that said, I just want to go on record, as I have before, King is a great writer. King's ability to put you into the story immediately and so thoroughly that you almost forget you're reading a story, it's deceptively simple. Like that, it's not something people can do, though a lot of people, especially in the 80s, tried to duplicate it. But he just has a way of making it look easy, but it's not. And it's an amazing gift. And I think, you know, King's a great writer. He's just not, you know, just not my writer, but he's a great writer.
That's fair. For sure. Yeah, I Straub is someone I wanted to talk to you a little more about overall as well, because I am very not well versed at all in Straub. And I mean, that just answered probably my main question I had about the man. But really the only things I've read by Straub are The Juniper Tree and his ghost story, the novel. Right. And those were both, I mean, so long ago that I hardly remember them. I remember liking them, but I've tried reading Straub since, and I'm very temperamental when it comes to what I like. I have to be in a very certain, it's why it takes me forever to find something to read. I'll start reading 10 books before I actually find one I'm committed to. And it's not because I don't like any of the other ones. It's just, sure you know what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, excuse me. And Straub is one that I want to get into so badly, and I'm just waiting for that mood to strike. And that actually, because I have been on more of a literary horror bent of late, and so I think I might have to give him another try. I'm in the mood.
Yeah, he's great. I mean, you know, The Juniper Tree was the story that I fell in love with when I first read it. Like, that's what turned me into a Straub fan. I read that on a Saturday afternoon, and it was just what the hell did I just read? I need more. You know, a lot of people like Shadowland as a novel. I kind of like the short stories a lot because he's a little more experimental with them. The Buffalo Hunter is a great novella. Mrs. God, his sort of Aikman riff, his Aikman-inspired story. It's great as well. And some of the short stuff. His introduction to the HWA anthology Ghosts, which starts as a starts as an introduction and then becomes a narrative on its own, you know, inspired me to kind of try and do something similar when I edited my first anthology for Grey Friar. Yeah, it's, you know, I could talk a lot about Straub, but he was great. He's a great writer. And he sorely missed.
Yeah, for sure. excuse me. Are you a big horror movie guy?
Not really, no.
No? Okay.
I don't like being scared. I think I've told you this in the past.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, no. I remember my sister watching Children of the Corn when it was on television, because back then you would put horror movies on cable TV or on network TV. And I remember hiding from it, not wanting to watch it. The first horror movie I watched was Friday the 13th Part 6, I think. I only watched it because my friends wanted to. And once I watched it, I was like, what the hell was I scared of all these years? I wasn't scary at all. So I watched a lot of those movies, a lot of the 80s, 90s movies. And then the Japanese horror movies started happening. And those I couldn't watch those. Those are too frightening for me. And so I don't watch a lot of horror movies. I do watch some of the more popular ones when they come out. The, you know, the stuff like the elevated horror, the A24 kind of horror.
Yeah.
I've watched a lot of those, but I'm emotionally damaged from Hereditary. I don't know if I'll ever recover from it fully. I don't even want to talk about it, to be honest with you. Let's not talk about Hereditary. Let's take that off the table.
No worries. No argument here.
Yeah. There was on Shudder, they did a series, sort of a history of horror. What the hell are they called now? There was like four of them. Do you remember? Did you ever see?
Was it hosted by Eli Roth?
No. They were like big document, In Search of Horror. I think they were called In Search of Horror. There was like four.
I've heard of it. I have not seen it.
All right. They were, and they take you through, it feels like through everything that wasn't mainstream really. And the more I watched it, the more I thought, yeah, I don't have a lot of affection for these grindhouse cheap horror movies. It's, you know, it's an interesting documentary, but they're just not, I don't miss them very much.
Yeah, for sure. Can you think back to when you were growing up? Is there like a scene from a movie that jumps out at you as being like the first one that scared the shit out of you?
No, not in the way you're talking, because I think by the time I started watching horror movies, they'd already become camp, basically. They were already joking. But what definitely terrified me as a kid, there's two things that really that terrified me as a kid. In terms of movies, the commercial for The Boogans, that was like late 70s horror movie with, I think it was like some sort of like giant turtle or something, I don't know, but I remember being terrified of that commercial whenever it came on TV. Like, I had nightmares about it, and I don't think I'm the only one. But yeah. And in terms of books, I had this book of children's horror stories called Tales for the Midnight Hour, and the cover of it had like a skeleton with like real eyeballs. And that would terrify me. That image terrified me so much. I found a copy of it in my parents' house a few years ago, and I'd scratched out the eyes. But it was so terrifying for me that when I would, like, you know, the lights would go out, I'd be going to sleep. I'd be so worried that the window shade would open and there'd be a person staring in at me. that I used to imagine Captain America coming in and beating up the monstrous things, so then I could feel more comfortable going to sleep, because, you know, Cap is there to help me. So
of course. That's awesome. I was a very scared child for sure, like, which does not match up with how I am now at all.
Right.
I have like a vague memory of watching like The Exorcist when I was far too young.
Yeah.
I have most of these things to thank my uncles, Adam and Steve, for. thank you guys. They're not going to watch this. I don't know why I'm saying it directly to them.
They'll find out.
Yeah, for sure they will. For sure. And then I remember watching Blair Witch with them. And I was just talking about this with one of the stars of the remake of Blair Witch. Or the sequel, sorry. Mm-hmm. And the very first time I can remember being truly scared to my core was the last 40 seconds of Blair Witch. And I was telling him, I was like, I felt so tough throughout that whole movie. I was like, this movie's not scary. Why is everyone freaking out about it? That last like 60 to 90 seconds happens. And I'm pretty sure I cried myself to sleep for like a week after that. It's just so masterfully done. And that was the one. And then I got into like The Ring, I saw.
Yeah.
And that was, I think, if I may be misremembering, but I think I went on my first like date to The Ring. I was in like sixth or seventh grade.
Right.
And I'm pretty sure I went with like a girl I liked or something. And I remember just like being so afraid and feeling like such a bitch watching that movie in the theater with the girl I wanted to like me.
Right.
And I mean, clearly we didn't last, and I have to imagine that's why.
Yeah, that's probably a reason. Yeah, I went camping a week after I saw the Blair Witch Project. So I was fine after leaving the theater, but I got to tell you, that night in that tent, I was not happy. Yeah.
I've never been and maybe it's because of Blair Witch, but I have always attributed the woods to, or like I've always considered the woods to just be like an inherently scary place. And I'm not an outdoorsy person at all. Yeah. And part of me wonders like if I wouldn't have watched Blair Witch, would I be a totally different person? Would I be, because I am such a homebody to the,
never know.
I am a recluse. Yeah. And I will, I'll never know. I'll never know. So kind of shifting gears a little bit again. I don't know why I keep saying that. Sorry. I'm still getting used to this whole podcasting thing.
It's a lot of gears to shift.
Yeah, right? So is there, of all the horror fiction you've read, is there like a certain playground? If you could write a story within someone else's fictional universe, or if you were, you know, tasked with doing so, and you could pick if you could write a story set in Derry, Maine, or the Sandman universe, or, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean, but I don't know if there is necessarily a place like that I would gravitate to. My stuff is just, it's my stuff. It's my peccadilloes. And I don't really know if there's any identifiable place written by another author that I'd be drawn to. Yeah, I really can't think of one. I just don't have that interest, I guess.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I've read quite a bit of your stuff, whatever I've, come across of it. Mm-hmm. And most of your stuff is set like kind of the here and now, if I'm not mistaken. More present day actual world.
Yeah, I don't. That's a whole tangent if you want to go down it. But
please.
Yeah, I don't. Now, obviously, there's always exceptions for what I'm about to say. And I think this was a whole Twitter brouhaha from someone else a few months ago. But I think horror works best, not only, but I think horror works best in the here and now. I think in order for horror to work, it needs to be breaking the rules of reality. And if you have to set the rules of reality up, it's hard for you to then break them later for a reader. Like, a reader needs to fundamentally understand how things work for the horror to be horrifying, to change what reality is. So if you have a fantasy story where there's orcs and elves and stuff like that, maybe that's even too high fantasy for what I'm talking about. But if you have a world where you're world building and you're setting up all the rules, and then something, let me back up to the orcs and the elves and stuff. You have orcs and you have the elves. And if all of a sudden you want to have a monstrous dragon show up, the person who's reading doesn't know, wait, is this part of this new world, or is this something unexpected and therefore horrifying? Like, it's difficult to cross. You can use horror elements like gore or what have you in order to get some of the cheaper thrills out of your reader. But if they don't know what the rules are, they don't know when the horrific intrusion is breaking them. So yeah, so my horror tends to stay in the real world and in the present, because if you go too far back in the past, the same thing applies. The further back you go, the more fantastical that world is to a reader, and the less they understand it intuitively. Again,
I would agree.
Broadly speaking.
Yeah, no, I would agree 100% with that. Like, I've never really thought about it, I guess, really to that extent, but I think I inherently agree that, yeah, orcs and elves for sure. You wouldn't.
Yeah.
It's hard to know if that dragon is something they know exists in that world versus if it is something wholly new to them too.
And even if you want to go say less dragon and more of like a ghoul or something, that's the same thing. Now, I'll point out an exception. One exception would be Nathan Bongrad's stories in his latest collection, In Wounds, where he has people going to hell. And it's, these are horrific stories, even though they're taking place in a more fantastical setting. Like, he does a great job of it. So it's not like you have to write him off 100%, but I just think it's a higher bar to clear when you're trying to do horror in a non-realistic setting. And I don't like high bars. I like to stay nice and easy.
I hear you. I'm the same way. Make me work the least to accomplish the most.
That's right. I can't wait till ChatGPT can write my stories for me. Looking forward to it.
All right. Well, it was nice knowing you. You're about to get roasted on Twitter now. I mean, that's another thing that's been, I mean, a real issue. I'm sure you've seen, like, there's people who are winning awards for generated stories. And I don't want to speak out of turn. Maybe that was just a rumor, but I could have sworn I read an article about a young woman who wrote, quote unquote.
I know an artist definitely won an award for AI generated artwork. I don't know about the story, but I wouldn't be surprised if that happened.
Yeah. And it's everywhere I submit to now has, little clauses there saying if it's discovered, we don't accept AI, which leads me to wonder, like, there have to be publishers that do accept AI, which is just, I don't know, that just seems so cheap to me.
Now, I'm not a 100% AI is garbage kind of guy. I think it's a tool, right, that you can use. And I've tried using it to say, I had a story I couldn't come up with a title for, so I put in all the prompts and I said, hey, come up with a title for this. And it was garbage, so I didn't use the titles. But, I tried. And I think, it's okay to kind of use it to help you put stuff together if you need it. But once you're actually using it to do the writing for you, it's a problem.
Yeah. For sure. Yeah, no, I agree. There's definitely benefits to it. If it's, used, I guess, responsibly may not be the right word, but it's just, when it's exploited,
it
is like we're seeing it being all the time. And honestly, I was pretty ignorant about it at first. I was the cover to my debut novel, which came out last year, was made partially with AI, and I kind of didn't get the ramifications of that. Yeah. I mean, ignorance isn't an excuse, obviously. Like I wouldn't do that again now, knowing that like the elements I got from the image that I generated using the AI were taken from other artists. Like, and
right.
I mean, if I could make amends with that, I would, but obviously you don't know who it's taking from or, you know, what pieces it's drawing inspiration from. But yeah, like it's a weird yeah. road that we're going down with all this AI stuff. And
well, every time there's a new technology, you get a flood of people trying to test the limits of it and what can you do and what's going to be acceptable. And eventually you find it, the industry, the world as a whole finds it, and you find the right balance of it. And it's just, AI is the new thing. A lot of people are going to try it out and try, can I write a story with AI and submit it? Can I get away with creating artwork wholly with AI? And then as we start putting in our rules and society comes to some sort of implicit agreement as to what is acceptable, it will all kind of fall into place and we'll stop worrying about it and just look for the next new boogeyman to chase after.
It's a good point. Yeah. I suppose we've seen that with a few different things throughout my few decades on this earth. excuse me. I think I'm getting sick. If I've been like clearing my throat a million times, sorry.
I hope it's not my fault. Hope I didn't give you anything.
So I think we got some little more time. What have you ever been a big fan of, like, the, let me rephrase that. Which would be the worst if it were, which of the universal monsters would be the worst to kind of, to be put into the real world? The Mummy, you know, vampire, wolfman, or Dracula, wolfman, Frankenstein, which would have the worst ramifications on real life as a whole?
Well, Frankenstein's monster would be bad because it would encourage people to use the new technology of resurrection in all sorts of crazy ways until we as a society came to some implicit agreement and putting some rules in place to prevent that from happening. So that, as a society, as something that's going to change the world, I guess Frankenstein might be the worst. You got your Draculas and your Wolfmans. They are like viruses and they're going to spread. So, you know, for the health of society, those would be pretty bad. The Mummy is just the Mummy. It's just a curse, right? And the Invisible Man's a jackass. So you can probably just rule those two guys out. So it's a matter of, do we want to be animalistic? Do we want a virus that makes us animalistic, sort of like the rage virus in 28 Days Later? Or do we want a romantic virus? Guys bring up this romantic virus, like an STD. Oh, man, there's a lot of questions. There's a lot of questions.
It is a loaded question for sure.
Yeah, you know. I think I would probably come down on the Frankenstein monster being the worst.
Yes, societally, I would have to. I mean, I think it's kind of objectively the best answer, or the correct answer. Like, you are.
Yeah.
Effectively ending death. And but then again, I suppose that like Dracula can sort of do the same if he turns people more into vampires, and then eventually just vampires turn all the humans and there's no more death that way too, and it's done in a much more violent fashion.
Well, you know, we did see I Am Legend, which it's basically the natural extrapolation of that. So we see how it turns out. And yeah, it doesn't sound like that's such a bad society at the end of everything.
Yeah, true. I wouldn't mind being the last dude on Earth.
Yeah.
I just need my cats.
Yeah. Just need my cats.
Yes, the way he had his dog there. I couldn't live without my cats. They've actually been very nice today. I have 5 cats here, and they have not bothered me one bit. This might be the first episode I've done that they haven't interrupted in some way. Thank you, guys. Sorry. So are you working on anything right now, or I guess that you can talk about?
Nothing I can really talk about. I have a new collection that came out at the end of last year, a new collection of short stories, and I have another one due next year probably. So right now I'm in this sort of hazy post coital sort of dreamland of having done a lot, and now I'm just sort of collecting myself and figuring out what I'm going to be doing next. I have some ideas, some longer ideas, some shorter ideas, but I haven't really settled on anything at the moment. I'm just kind of enjoying not feeling the grind, feeling the drive to produce like I did for the last 20 years.
Yeah, for sure. Is there, for your last collection and then the forthcoming one, is there anyone in particular, or I guess any kind of style or subgenre in particular you've been kind of more gravitating toward or focusing on a little more?
Yeah, so the last collection that came out a few months ago, Only the Living Are Lost, has a lot of sort of weird noir stories in it. I think it's probably the most accessible of my collections. It's got more collectively stories that have been in year's best books or been nominated for awards or that sort of thing. So I think it's a lot of good stuff in that one. The next collection will be probably more of a sister to my previous collection, Nothing Is Everything, which was more, I would call them less horror stories and more, you know, weird stories. Like, people don't really die in that book. Just weird shit starts to happen to them. So I think the next book's going to be more like that. Really, ideally, I would like to kind of move in that direction as a writer. I mean, I really enjoy the challenge of these weird anti-horror kind of stories. But I know eventually I'll get tired of doing them and want to put a monster in again. So it's a constant yin and yang with me. It's go soft, go hard, go soft, go hard.
That's a good thing. You don't want any one method of doing thing to get stale. So that's awesome, yeah, man. So you said the Only the Living Are Lost was your most recent collection?
Yes. Yeah, came from Hippocampus last year.
Okay, awesome. I'll put a link to that in the show notes in the video description. And where can people find you if you want them to?
I am reluctantly on Facebook and on Twitter and on Blue Sky and on Instagram, though I don't really participate as much as I used to. Instagram doesn't really, I don't really do much on, but you know, if you go to Blue Sky or Twitter, I'm probably most active on one of the two of them. Yeah. One of those, and Facebook, one of those three. That's probably the best way to find me.
All right. Awesome. And is it at Simon Strancis?
At Strancis.
At Strancis. Oh, S. I've got one of those names.
No, just at Strancis.
Oh, gotcha.
I've got a name that's unique enough that I can get away with it.
For sure. So, for sure. I was lucky enough to get my name at gmail.com, which I've had numerous people comment on how they haven't been able to, how they're like surprised I was able to do that. So I feel lucky.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Simon, I really do appreciate you coming on and talking to me. I hope I didn't fumble my way through this too bad.
I hope I gave you some good answers.
Oh, you definitely did, man. I enjoyed talking to you when I did it for that book that I am still working on, I swear. I did once again today, man. So yeah, I will talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Later.